If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
We've driven through so many different properties that just have tons of vacant lots. They're just totally mismanaged, and we want to make sure that we're excelling through operations.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Dylan is a principal of the Requity Group and manages investor communications, oversees acquisitions, and plays a very active role within TRG Living, the Requity Group's in-house management company. With 6 years of real estate investing experience, he has been the lead sponsor or JV'd on $55 million in transactions. Dylan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Oh, man, this is great. This is great. Same questions asked. Everybody who comes on, can you give us a brief overview of where you started, where you are now, and how you got there?
So I'm initially from upstate New York, and when I was 20 years old, I moved out to Southern California, San Diego, to get myself involved with real estate investing in any way, shape, or form that I could at the time. I began working for a real estate investing education platform out of San Diego. And fortunately, it was a great environment, great workplace for me to surround myself with a lot of investors that had experience with single family, residential, commercial, multifamily, industrial, and so on. And after spending a few years there, I really caught the bug for multifamily and multifamily syndication. I had done a little bit of investing into single family. I bought a single family and a duplex along the way. But when I saw the vehicle that multifamily could provide for oneself, and I saw the sort of the entrepreneurial path that it could take someone on, I didn't really look back. At that point, I devoted all my time and energy into learning everything I could about the space. And after a little bit over a year of studying in any minute of free time that I had, I ended up getting into a 21 unit with myself and a few of my friends that was in upstate New York. And then I moved out to the Southeast because I realized that San Diego was pretty far away from most of the main markets that I was interested in investing in. And I had my sights set on Atlanta, which lasted about 6 to 8 months before moving up to Tennessee and partnering with my former company and partners. And at that point, we began to syndicate deals. We did about 500 doors or so of syndications. And then along the way, I've done about 300 units of joint ventures in apartments. And then up until beginning of last year, we basically just got to a point where my partners and I had different goals and trajectories at different, you know, different points in our lives. So we went different directions. And then I formed the Requity Group, or TRG, which is the brand I'm operating under currently, and took a little bit of a pivot and began to buy a bunch of mobile home parks. So closing right now in the next few weeks on our third acquisition, which will put us at over 300 doors of mobile home parks. And we're also built a management company where we're actively managing all of the mobile home parks that we're acquiring. We have a $10 million fund in place to acquire mobile home parks throughout the Southeast. So it's expected that we'll continue to buy mobile home parks as well as apartments over the years to come. And we are now based out of sunny Tampa, Florida.
Gotcha. Okay. That's really cool. I mean, good for you, one, for, you know, pivoting. I think that's hard. It's hard on anyone, but you know, when you see that there's a different direction you want to go, you know, getting that done is, there's no way to do it other than just do it. And then, you know, you got to deal with things the way they shake out. So you were actively buying multifamily and then decided that, hey, I also have an interest in mobile home parks. How did you educate yourself on that space?
It was really just a light bulb moment after having conversations with a dozen friends that had been involved in the space in different capacities. I was speaking to a gentleman that had done, I think it was 3,000 or 4,000 units of mobile homes. And he was just telling me about his experience and sort of the return projections that he's finding in some of the markets he's in. And I had that light bulb moment where I saw that when you look at any type of investment, I'm a big believer that we're paying attention to the risk-adjusted return over anything else, right? Understanding not only the opportunity and what the return possibilities are like, but also the risk that's underlying behind that opportunity, right? And I think when I really had the click moment was when I started to see that the average tenant lease length on a tenant-owned home within a mobile home park can be 30-plus years. And I started to realize that the collections ratio was, in many cases, as high as 98, 99% for a lot of these mobile homes. I realized that the fact that these things have been trading at higher cap rates than a lot of what I would perceive as riskier alternatives really was where I saw a disconnect, and I saw that there's value to be found in this space.
Right. That's cool. Let's talk about your fund. I think that's a fun thing to discuss. How did you come up with the idea? How did you get it across the line? What did it cost to get it set up? How have you funded it? How did you sell it to investors? Give us the whole rundown on your fund.
So I mainly have only done traditional syndication structures before getting into the fund. The fund is something that I've had on my radar and something I've researched for quite a bit of time before actually pursuing one. But we've always done, previous to that, it was always deal by deal syndications, right? It was did that for all the apartment deals as well as for the first mobile home deal that we did. And then my partner and I were looking at a lot of different deals, and we realized that the fund model seems to make a lot of sense for a few reasons. In the mobile home park space, your average deal size is a bit smaller, because the cost per unit is relatively low comparative to multifamily. You might be at 30 to 50,000 cost per unit versus 100 to 150,000, we'll say, depending on the market, of course. So when you're buying 100 unit park, it's still only, could be a $3 to $5 million investment, right? Which is, if you're doing a deal by deal raise, those raises will go extremely fast. And you'll have investors sometimes frustrated that there's not enough room in the deals that you're doing and whatnot. So we saw that there was a lot of benefit to having the ability to still pursue some of the smaller deals that would maybe not be ideal for a one-off syndication, to be able to get these really high yields that are harder to find on the larger type deals, to have a diversified return where you have a blend of different properties that have different risk profiles in place. We're pursuing mainly value add mobile homes because we think, it's our view that the low hanging fruit is gone. You're not going to be able to find this perfect all tenant owned home community in a great growing metro area right now at a high cap rate. You're either going to have to buy it at a very low cap rate, or you're going to have to take on some kind of hair or some kind of problem. So our goal is to find the stuff that has problems that are getting in the way of institutional buyers having the appetite for them. So we're buying stuff that has a large amount of park-owned home, and then we're selling off the homes through a home ownership program and converting it to something that an institution is going to want to buy later on down the line. We're buying stuff that has vacant lots and vacant land that we can do infill plays on, or buying stuff that's dramatically under market rent, as long as there's some kind of reasonable timeline that we can get it to market without going too fast. So that's sort of our thesis, is that by having a blend of these different types of deals, I think you're going to end up with a great risk-adjusted return, because some of these models are higher cash flow, some of them are lower cash flow, but higher upside.
How does that work? When you bring an investor into the fund, let's say, well, let me ask you this. You said it's a $10 million fund, so it's a closed-end fund, right? Mm-hmm. Right. So how much of that have you raised to date?
We're about 40%.
Okay. So you got 4 million of the 10 million, and that 4 million on the front end, and this is a question I have because I've not done a fund before, so I'm really curious how this works. The $4 million on the front end, how do they get preferential treatment, for their money being in the deal or in the fund longer than the people that come in, for the last $100,000 at 990 or 109, what I'm saying?
Yep. No, it's definitely a fair question, and something you have to think about is how do you incentivize the early adopters, the early movers within the fund? So there's a few things. Back to your initial point about the startup costs. Any startup costs are split across all investors. And to start a fund that's this size, it's really not expensive at all. It's probably costs us the same amount that a traditional syndication has in the past. So I know people think that the cost prohibits a lot of people in funds. When you start doing funds that are closed-ended that are 25 million plus, you haven't seen it. From my understanding, I haven't done it yet, but there's some really high level costs that that come into play when you start having to file with the SEC. But for smaller funds, you can really do them in a really cost effective manner, which I think gives you some economies of scale and actually saves the investors money when it comes to the legal structure and things along those lines. And happy to share the resources at any point. But then when it comes to the actual fundraising, we had The first deal closed at the end of last year, and we incentivized the early investors by giving them a preferential amount of the depreciation on the first deal. Because one of the big things in the mobile home space is that the depreciation can be really, really exciting. So we've actually, as the sponsors, we're forgoing all depreciation. We're passing 100% of it through to the investors, and we're giving them, we gave the early movers the bulk load of that first deal, which will make up probably 10% or less of the total fund. But that was a way to reward the early adopters, if you will. And then beyond that, we're also giving them, basically they are getting all cash flows up until the point that someone else comes in. So if someone else comes in and their percentage of ownership is now less, but they own, you know, a little bit less of a bigger pie, right? They will have received all the cash flows along the way. And if we ever fall short of the preferred return of 8%, which we're paying out on a monthly basis, if we fell short of that at any point, the future investors would have to cover the shortfall. So they would come in to buy the pro rata share plus cover any shortfall on the preferred return, which gives the early investors some insulation that during that first year, which can, you know, usually the first year is going to be the hardest year when it comes to getting the property stabilized and cash flowing and get, you know, doing the value add program. So during that first year, they feel a certain level of confidence that they're going to be getting that 8% or more.
Right, right. So what's the timeline for when you started the fund to when you anticipate taking the last dollar into it?
So we started the fund. We launched it in December, just a few months ago. We really haven't actively marketed it all that much. We've done one webinar with our existing base of investors, but more than anything, we wanted to get an initial layer of capital in to buy our first three deals, ideally, and then buy those first three deals, knock it out of the park with our acquisitions or with our operations on those first three deals, building the infrastructure, and then we'll go back out and do a little bit more active marketing to finish up the fundraising side of things. And then at that point, the goal, the objective is to have it all completely fundraised and committed for by the end of the first 12 months, we'll say. And then we will probably deploy it in 12 to 18 months. We're really trying to take a crawl, walk, run sort of approach to deploying the capital and doing it at a pace that's really sustainable, allowing us to really effectively build the foundation, right? I think that's the overall goal, is to build trust with the investors, to build a foundation that's impeccable and that will allow us to scale and do this at a much higher level. So more than anything, we've been really spending a lot of our time and attention, less so on marketing and more so on the operations side of things, just really developing strong KPIs, putting the right team in place, building the right infrastructure to be able to scale and do it very well. Because that's a mistake I think I see a lot of people make in this space, is that they go chasing, deals that look really attractive. They don't build it strategically, so they get spread out. They have deals that are all over the whole country versus getting economies of scale in specific markets. And then two, they buy at a speed that they don't have the bandwidth or the infrastructure to effectively manage. So we've driven through so many different properties that just have tons of vacant lots. They're just totally mismanaged. And we want to make sure that we're excelling through operations.
Right, right. No, I think that's very smart. That's very smart. What type of leverage is there in the mobile home park space?
Typically, we'll say 2/3 of the total deal will be leveraged. We've had a lot of the time 75% to 80% of the purchase price. When we're dealing with the park-owned home model, we've actually found some really attractive options that have allowed us to get up to 80% leverage on both the land, the real estate side, plus the homes, which is something that was not available a few years ago. So there's a lot of interesting, creative debt products that are becoming more widely available. And I think even the agencies are becoming more friendly towards the asset class.
Right, right. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, so if you're at 80% levered and you're raising $10 million, then you've got really a $50 million worth of acquisition that you guys could potentially take down.
Plus, we'll have a bunch of CapEx funds and closing costs and stuff like that. So I think even if we're 80% levered, we'll probably still have, another 5-10% on the sidelines. But yeah, that's roughly the idea. I like to think that we'll probably buy comfortably a little bit over 30 when it's all, if you factor everything.
Gotcha.
Else in.
Gotcha. Okay. That's really cool. Talk to us about depreciation. You mentioned this and I'm curious because I don't know anything about really mobile home park investing. What is there to depreciate in a mobile home park if maybe you don't own the homes. Like, what do you, you basically have, you know, a parking lot. So what can you write off?
That's a great question. The depreciation, typically when you break down a property, you have several layers of depreciation. When you do a cost segregation study, the goal is, of that is basically an engineering and accountancy study where they're going to go in and determine the useful life of all the different components of the property. The first thing is that you can't depreciate land, right? So the land on, say, an apartment complex, it might be 10-20%, right? And with the mobile home park, we find that's still actually pretty similar. You might think that the land is making up a lot more than that, but a lot of the times these aren't in the most desirable locations. The land doesn't actually hold that much value, because when you actually look at what it would take to develop the infrastructure to build a mobile home park in today's environment, you're probably looking at 30,000 or so. I'm not a developer, so it's hard to quote me on this, but I think it's you can certainly say that it might take you up to $30,000 just to build the infrastructure, depending on the way that the infrastructure is being built, because you're going to have to run city water, city sewer, or build septic tanks. And then you're going to have to pave the roads. You're going to have to put the lighting in, the signage in. You build the office, right? There's a lot that goes into it. So this is talking, even if you don't own the homes, you know, there's still going to be a significant amount of expense just to building the park, which can make most of that broken down on one of the different useful life schedules that will take place. And I believe it's 27, 15, and 5, where the bulk load of our investment gets broken down into. And most of these infrastructure items that we're talking about are not in the 27-year category, right? Some of them may be, but a lot of it is going to fall into the shorter timelines of 15-year or 5-year depreciation schedules. And with the current laws in place and bonus depreciation in place, we're allowed to write the bulk load of that upfront off, right? And that probably only lasts a few more years. But right now we're getting really substantial depreciation day one after doing the studies on the parks to the extent where it's not uncommon to see someone's entire initial investment being matched with their loss that they're receiving in the first year.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. That makes sense. And that's great. That's great. That's what you want. That's really interesting. Yeah, those aren't things I would have thought about, is how to, you know, what a cost segregation study would look like on a mobile home park. Because I think how long is cost or bonus depreciation good through? Is that the end of this year? Or is that 2022?
I want to say that there's maybe 2 or 3 more years on right. it. I want to say 2024, but I'm not too sure. And maybe they'll extend it.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows? That's really,
we'll take a look.
Right. That's interesting. Talk to us about building out your operational team. I mean, are these parks that you guys are self-managing?
Yeah, so we're self-managing. We're pretty big believers in that, because unlike multifamily, you can build a very, very large multifamily portfolio in one city, right? If you look at Atlanta, for instance, you can acquire 10,000 doors of multifamily just being heavy in that one city or metro. So property management companies have some serious economies of scale operating in the major metros when you're looking at multifamily third-party companies. It's not quite the same with the mobile home park space, plus the rents are lower. So I just don't think it's as profitable of a business. And there's a lot more, it's a little bit more difficult to find really quality third-party companies. There are a few out there. So, and I think for a lot of investors, that does make sense. But we are pretty big advocates for self-managing and sort of controlling the processes the best we can on the stuff that we're doing, especially these value-add type deals. So we have the infrastructure is typically on site. You have your traditional community manager. And then if the property has a lot of park-owned homes, you'll also have full-time maintenance. If it doesn't have a lot of park-owned homes, you probably will not have full-time maintenance. You'll probably have more so a community manager. We have to think about the type of property, because if there's a large park-owned home component, then you're going to have a manager that's dealing with 50% of the park-owned homes turning over each year, because that's the average turnover for apartments, just like it is for homes. But if they're not, then you're going to have radically less turnover, and their job's going to be much, much easier, much simpler. You might only need to have a weekly check-in versus if they're dealing with constant turnover, we do daily check-ins in that event, right? So that's what you're going to have on the property. You're going to have oftentimes, community manager in every property, you'll have someone, and then you also have some maintenance staff depending on the makeup of the property and the homes. And then beyond that, we have our operations manager, Jen, who's does a great job with managing the managers. So her and I do the daily touch points with all of the managers and just sort of keep in sync the best we can. And then she deals with a lot of the HR side of things, a lot of the business development side of things on the property management, which is certainly a full-time thing, or maybe two full-time jobs in itself. And then beyond that, when it comes to the infrastructure on the management side, you have your accounting systems. Currently, we've been outsourcing our bookkeeping overseas, and we've have a team there that we're happy with. It's been great for us. But and then you have your, you know, you can go different directions, but eventually I'm sure we'll be hiring more so regional type managers and maybe a full-time marketing manager as well.
Right. How far apart are your parks?
Two of them are 40 minutes, and then the other one's in a different state. It's going to be about 4 or 5 hours right now. But we're really trying to make sure that we, any market we enter, we don't want to do just one deal in. So it's going to be our full intention to scale specifically in the markets that we're in.
Right, right. Yeah, that was going to be the question. So your managers and the people that are, you know, taking care of these daily check-ins and taking care of making sure that the park is in the condition it should be in, are they people living at the park? Or are they somebody that you've just hired locally? How do you vet them? How do you find them? What's that look like?
They usually live off site. So typically they live off site. Not that we have a strong preference. It just tends to work out that way. But we'd be open to either sort of setup. But whether they live on or off site, we'll be able to hire through simply putting out job ads. And two out of three of these situations, we've been able to assume the existing managers, which is always a lot of benefit in, because they already kind of know the ins and outs and they already have existing relationships with the residents. And in the instances that we need someone new, we just go traditional routes of going online to hire.
Right, right, right. That's cool. That's cool. Is there anything else you want to add to this conversation before we jump into the final four?
No, I think it's just really understanding that with this space, there is a lot of direct management, right? That's a huge part of it. So I think when you're looking at these value add deals, you really want to be aware of how much of your time is going to be needed depending on the type of deal. Because if you're looking at this as a more of a passive model, then you probably want to target deals that are going to operate that way.
Right. No, that's a great point. That's a great point. Yeah. And especially if you're doing the heavy lifts like you are, you know, that's going to be a really hands-on project, I would think, or those would be hands-on projects, I would think, versus, you know, being just a passive investor or something, something a little easier to tackle. But it sounds like for you, the appropriate reward is also there for, you know, getting those things done.
Exactly.
So, yeah, that's really cool. That's really cool. Let's jump here in the final four. What is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
When it comes to scaling up, I would say one piece of advice that I received early on is slow down to speed up. So as much as we want to scale, I think the beginning of launching a new company is extremely important to move slower and be extremely thoughtful about why you're doing things, documenting your processes, and building the metrics that will allow you to effectively scale.
Right. Love that. What's one thing you're currently doing to stay on top of your game?
I'm big into reading. I constantly reading different, you know, books every day, articles, and big into meditating as well.
Gotcha. That's cool. That's very cool. When it comes to giving back, what is one way you are making the world a better place?
My main form of contribution right now is simply just spending time with my peers and people around me, just seeing how I can be the best version of myself, contributing to them and being generous to those in my life.
Gotcha. No, that's cool. That's very cool. If our listeners want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
As far as social media, the platform I'm really active on more than anything is LinkedIn. So you can certainly find me on there. And you can also visit our website at therequitygroup.com. That is the R-E-Q-U-I-T-Y group.com. And you can find all my contact info from there.
Awesome. Dylan, thanks so much for your time. Certainly appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Sam. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.